Anyone who lives in London for an extended period will realise eventually that Londoners are somewhat passionate about our politics. We always have been. As I write these words, we're approaching the mayoral elections for the City of London in 2024. Mayor Sadiq Khan, his Conservative rival Susan Hall, and the candidates for the Greens and the Liberal Democrats are all trying to canvass last-minute votes as I release this episode. They're not alone. You have representatives of the Reform Party, the Britain First Party, and you have a plethora of independents all running around, and their policies range from single issues to do with the emission zones to trying to not remind everybody they once said COVID didn't exist. And you also have Lord Binface, a comedy character who wears a bin on his head and managed to beat over half the candidates at the last election with a whopping 1% of the vote, which goes to show that London's sense of humour is as strong as ever. But it's easy to think that our political rows and arguments are passionate and strong. Please. We live in a sedate era of peaceful politics compared to the London of the past. And indeed, I think it's time we examined a few years where politics in the city was really intense. Again. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city as a single narrative tale, each part taking us a little further along the grand story of the city and its residents. And so we've reached the year 1249, and in case this is your first time listening, just to provide a little bit of context, about 30 years previously to this date, London had been the bedrock and maybe the actual instigators of a grand rebellion against the then King, John. It had thrown its weight and maybe even triggered a bunch of rebellious barons to rise up against King John, and the end result was not only the Magna Carta, but also, more importantly, London actually inviting the heir to the throne of France to come over to England, set up base in London, and then try to fight for the throne. He could have well succeeded, but King John died, his baby boy Henry III became king, and that war faded out. London had been formally forgiven for their acts and deeds in that era. But for the last three decades or so, relations between the city and the king had been on the back foot. For obvious reasons, Henry III was hostile to London and was reported to have said, as I mentioned last episode, quote, "These coarse Londoners who call themselves barons are rolling in money. That city is an inexhaustible well," unquote. Henry III saw Londoners as coarse and uppity, only good for the cash they could give him. And Henry was in dire need of cash. Over the last few episodes, we've covered how he and the city were at loggerheads and had been for quite a few years. And things, as we'll see this episode, are about to get so much worse. So welcome then to chapter 93 of The Story of London, as we explore the King of London's ongoing relationship descending into more acrimony and dislike, and then add on top of that, a moment when the Archbishop of Canterbury, the King's brother-in-law, started a fistfight in the Church of St. Bartholomew's. Welcome then to a rumble in St. Bart's. We start our story at the Christmas of 1248, going into the new year of 1249, and King Henry III was celebrating the festive season in Westminster. Coming up on January 5th is the feast of St. Edward the Confessor, his favourite saint, and Henry liked to invite folks around for a lavish party on said date. But such parties cost money, and guess what? As usual, Henry III was broke. How to earn some money over the Christmas holidays, eh? Well, the day before, on January 4th, the king, we read, quote, "demanded from each of the citizens of London individually whom he knew to be among the more wealthy those earliest presents of the year, which common people are wont to superstitiously call New Year's gifts," unquote. So yeah, Happy New Year, London. Where are my presents? Give me my presents, London. Give me my presents now. Well, what can I say? The rich Londoners coughed up New Year's prezzies and now armed with the expensive gifts. Quote, the Lord King summoned by letter a large number of magnates to celebrate the feast with him splendidly in St. Peter's Church, Westminster, unquote. So yeah, as the new year began, relations between the city and the king started off badly. And then it got worse. Indeed, things had been going really badly since the previous October. As I covered last episode, the king had forcibly closed down all the shops in London for 2 weeks so that no one could divert any trade from his grand fair over in the grounds of Westminster Abbey, an event that was utterly miserable, cold and wet. But the year before, when Michael Tovey had been elected mayor, a man who the king seemed to have issues with, London and the king had fallen out over some long-winded legal case, and because of that, the king had suspended the liberties of London. His people ran the city, not the Londoners themselves. Now, that legal case wasn't really important. It was one of those ones that, well, it's the principle that matter type arguments. And in reality, the king was using this legal case just as a way to get London over a barrel in order to extract money like he would do to them in the new year. So before that New Year's, round about October and November, the king was clearly trying to use the issue of the city running itself as a way to extract more concessions and money from them. So while the fair had been going on, quote, the mayor and the citizens appeared at Westminster to make answer as to the judgment before mentioned, unquote. And even though they're here to talk about that long-winded court case, the king made them a new offer, and he, quote, requested them to permit the Abbot of Westminster to enjoy the franchises which the king had granted him in Middlesex in exchange for other liberties which the citizens might of right demand, unquote. Which basically translates to, the rebuilding of Westminster Abbey was costing a fortune. And for the king, basically, if London would allow the Abbot of Westminster the right to collect tithes and taxes from London, that would pay for it, and if they would agree, he'd give them their city back. At this, the London delegation stalled. Quote, to which the citizens made answer that they could do nothing as to such matter without the consent of the whole community, unquote. So they're not saying no to his face, but clearly saying, oh, we just need to gather everyone together to agree to that, which played for time. This clear answer of not yes had annoyed the king, and, quote, as though moved to anger, made them appear before him, and after much altercation had passed as to the said judgment, the mayor and the citizens were acquitted and took their departure, unquote. Yeah, the king had tried to use his legal case to get London to give up their rights and liberties, but the city held firm, and the king eventually had to relent. But this was not a black and white issue. There had been, just before that new year, plenty within London who sided with the king, a royal party faction, opposed to the diehards who were busy defending the rights of the city. And we saw in the aftermath of this how this internal city politics reared its head. And it was all about an alderman called Simon Fitzmary. I mentioned him last episode. Simon Fitzmary was the alderman of London who had granted the land the new priory of Bethlehem Hospital, Bedlam, was established upon under the rule of the Bishop of Bethlehem. It so happened that due to him siding with the king over the city in the past, Simon Fitzmary had been suspended once by Michael Tovey in the past and was basically warned, if you side against the city again, we'll remove you from office. So Alderman Fitzmary was clearly on thin ice with Mayor Tovey of London and his supporters. And in lieu of this, when the above court case had finally been thrown out and London got its liberties back, quote, the said Simon had manifestly sided in the complaint made to his lordship the king as to the judgment given by the citizens, unquote. So basically, here was one alderman who was busy saying the city should give in to the king, when he wasn't busy handing over land to the king's foreign friends like the Bishop of Bethlehem. And because of this, and also, quote, for many other evil and detestable actions, of which he had secretly been guilty against the city, the mayor took his aldermanry into his own hands and wholly removed him therefore, unquote. Yep, Mayor Tovey was making a statement back at the king, and this pro-royalist alderman was removed from his position and the members of his ward elected a new representative. So this had been what was going on just before the king did his whole Happy New Year, now give me some cash routine that January. So as you can imagine, things were tense. And then the king doubled down. Matthew Paris records that immediately after the feast of St. Edward the Confessor, quote, he set about harassing the citizens of London in the following way. As had been mentioned above, he had suspended trade in the city for a fortnight, having instituted a new fair at Westminster to the harm and prejudice of many. And directly after this, he sent by letters by his satellites containing detailed and peremptory prayers asking the citizens to help him with substantial financial aid. At this, they grumbled heartily, saying, alas for us, alas, where is the liberty of London, so often bought, so often conceded, so often written down, so often sworn to, for almost every year, like vile slaves of the lowest status, we are impoverished by different taxes and injuriously attacked with fox-like cunning. Nor can we find out into what whirlpool the goods we are despoiled of are submerged. What more can be said? Although incalculable sums were demanded, the citizens at length, unwillingly and not without bitter resentment, agreed to a contribution of £2,000 to be paid to the Lord King over a short period. Moreover, his habitual oppression raged without any restraint, for all saleable articles, especially meat and drink, if not hidden away as if stolen, were seized for the king's use, unquote. Wow. So this is basically an eyewitness recording that the king was demanding more cash and more goods from London and even hoarding to himself food and drink from the city's richer dwellers. The narrative we have been given is one of the king seemingly endlessly sniping away at the city on the River Thames. Allow me to ask you a question, dear listener. Allow me to ask a question and implant an idea into your head now. How much of this crap do you think London was going to take before it snapped? Henry III really comes across as a great grafter king of England, always begging and needing money. With it being reported, he was accosting the nobles of England at the same time and making statements like this, quote, I am a poor man, completely broke. It is essential that each of you gives me substantial aid, for I am indebted by charter in the sum of 30,000 marks. However, I demand nothing except as a favour. If anyone does me a favour, I shall return it to him when the time comes. And if anyone denies me a favour, I shall deny it to him. Unquote. I mean, seriously. Yes, we have to take on board the bias of some of the sources, especially Matthew Paris, who was writing at the time, and who I quote heavily. But even mostly pro-royalist sources cannot disguise easily the fact that London and this king were endlessly clashing over the king's need for cash and for London to simply obey his word as they would obey the word of God. Henry III comes across as easily as the most money-orientated king of England ever. And of course, this was because he was broke, but that was down to him. It is worth noting that the annals from this year do say that, quote, in this year, Roger FitzRoger was elected mayor, and that this too in his absence, and was afterwards admitted by the king at Rochester, unquote. So, early in the year, it does seem that London had its liberties back, and as the year went on, a new mayor who dis routine and Roger FitzRoger seems to have been acceptable, or less problematic than Michael Tovey had been as mayor. But these new relations were not to last for long. We read that during that year, quote, nearly all the men as well as women of London having met together in accordance with the precept of his lordship the king in the great hall of Westminster, his lordship the king assumed the cross with a view for setting out in aid of the Holy Land, unquote. And that segues into something else. We're talking about the relations between the king and London, but there were other events happening elsewhere in the world. This year, the whole of Western Europe seemed to be hanging on the news of Louis IX of France, who had launched what was to be known as the Seventh Crusade into Egypt. And this was a huge event and took up everyone's attention. A large group of English crusaders had gone and more were going. And the conditions around this large body of people going on crusade had seen those who were going to go on crusade calls for reforms for how England should be run. And London witnessed what this meant when on 11th of April that year, quote, "At the close of Easter, the magnates of England, as had been previously agreed amongst themselves, assembled in London for the Lord King to do what he had all events often promised, namely appoint a chancellor, justiciar and treasurer on their advice. But just as they believed themselves certainty on the point of achieving everything, the absence of Earl Richard, who appeared to be their leader, entirely prevented any progress in this matter. He had gone to Cornwall some time before as if on business, and was thus far off. So the deluded magnates returned home," unquote. But the issue of a load of nobles ready to go on crusade and wanting the king to set up protocols to protect their holdings, aka not trusting him to pinky promise not to steal their riches while he was away, does seem to be an overwhelming issue that was obviously going on in the background behind London falling out with the king. And it does seem that they trusted the king's brother to be their spokesman. Meanwhile, Henry III was like a dog with a bone when it came to the idea he had had about allowing the abbot of Westminster Abbey gather monies from the cities. As the year went on, quote, "His lordship the king had repeatedly requested the citizens to grant the abbot of Westminster the franchises which we have already mentioned in this record," unquote. And these requests were being obviously rebuffed, and the whole matter was getting heated, and it got so heated that eventually, quote, "There was a day of love appointed," unquote. A day of love, or a love day, is a lovely term. It's a medieval shorthand for a day where all the sides in a row come to bury the hatchet. So we can tell this row between the Abbot of Westminster wanting to raise revenues in the city and the king supporting him and the citizens of London saying no was ongoing, and it was so bad now it needed a ceasefire day. Talks were arranged over this, and we read, quote, "The mayor and the countless multitude of the citizens with him came to the new temple where the abbot was, there being also present William de Haverhill, the treasurer, Henry de Bay, Roger de Turkeby, and John de Gatestein, justiciars, and others who would have been sent thither by the king," unquote. So a large delegation from the court, and oh look, there are peace talks between the crown and London happening at the headquarters of the Knights Templar. Halfway between the King's town of Westminster and London, the headquarters of the Templars had long been established as a neutral middle ground between London and Westminster. It should be remembered the last time we saw this had been the talks between London and the King here, as I covered back in chapter 83, and that ended up triggering the events that led to the creation of the original Magna Carta. This kind, the king's delegation were simply raising the demands of the Abbot of Westminster. Quote, "Upon these desiring to hold a conference with the mayor and aldermen, the whole of the populace opposed it, and would not allow them, without the whole of the commons being present, to treat at all of the matter, all of them exclaiming in one voice that in no point would they recede from their wanted franchises, which, by the charters of his lordship the king and his predecessors, they possessed. Upon this, a day was given them by the justiciars to appear before his lordship the king at Windsor, the Tuesday following, namely. And solely for this reason, the king took the city into his hands and delivered it to William the treasurer and to Peter Blund, the constable of the tower, all the clerks and sergeants of the sheriffwick," unquote. Yep, once again, the king took over the running of London because London would not comply with his demands. This row between Westminster and London was ongoing and growing, and had yet a while to go. That summer rolled along. The weather was foul and harsh. Quote, "At the beginning of June, such a huge deluge of rain fell that willows and other trees and houses near the rivers and streams and even sheepcotes and the sheep in them, salt works and mills with bridges and a chapel not far from Abingdon were carried away. The green corn with its sprouting ears coming into flower was levelled to the ground, so that bread afterwards seemed to be made from bran rather than wheat," unquote. Considering that Abingdon on Thames is upriver from London, just 6 miles from Oxford, we could imagine this terrible weather and these floods impacted upon the city. By late summer, the whole argument over Westminster trying to raise money at London's expense seems to have reached a boiling point when a sudden development changed everything. The monks of Westminster Abbey sided with the Londoners, and as the records clearly say, quote, "At the same time, dissension arose between the Abbot of Westminster and the monks of this convent, to the disgrace and the scandal of the entire order of black monks," unquote. And that, quote, "The Lord King did his best to re-establish peace between the Abbot of Westminster and the convent of that place, for the scandal of this dispute spread throughout the religious community. Indeed, it infected the entire region. The King was even told that he would have laid himself out to no purpose on the rebuilding of the church in Westminster, namely in the carving and fitting the stones, if the personnel of the church, that is the pastor and his flock or abbot and convent, who are the living stones in the makeup of such a noble building, were so improperly in dispute. Thus, by efforts of the Lord King, who was fond of that church, peace was re-established between them," unquote. Now, I cannot be sure and understand I'm utterly simplifying things anyway for the purpose of telling a narrative story, but it does seem that there was a deep argument going on about the behaviour of the King's Court and the Abbot of Westminster towards London coming from the monks of Westminster Abbey. And looking at other sources, it does suggest that possibly the reason why they actually fell out with the Abbot was the King had just decided, do you know what? I'm just going to let the abbot have what he wants. With the king now in charge, he just sided on behalf of the abbot of Westminster. And this had caused a wider political row, because we know that the sources say, quote, "About the same time, the city of London was not a little agitated, because the Lord King extracted certain liberties from the citizens for the benefit of the abbot of Westminster, to their substantial loss and in infringement of their privileges. The mayor of the city, Roger Fitzroger, with the entire commune unanimously opposed, insofar as they could, the wishes, or rather the violence and raving of the king. But the king behaved harshly and inexorably towards them. So the citizens, in a state of great excitement, went to Earl Richard, the Earl of Leicester, and other magnates of the kingdom, grieving and complaining, to explain how the king was not ashamed to violate their charters granted by his predecessors. The aforesaid magnates, extremely disturbed by this, fearing that the king might attempt something similar against them, remonstrated severely with him, adding threats, and having remonstrated with him, reproved him, and even more severely, contradicted the abbot, whom they believed had been the author and originator of this wrong, adding insults and imprecations, which it would not be right to recite here out of respect for the order. And so the discretion of the magnates happily recalled the king from his planned aggression," unquote. So yeah, they appealed to others and eventually the matter was dropped. Indeed, we read that the king is being contrite, really contrite. We read that, quote, "All the citizens of London, with their families down to 12-year-old boys, were summoned by command of the Lord King to appear before him in the large palace which is called the Great Hall at Westminster. And it and the whole of its courtyard were filled with crowds of people. When they were assembled, the Lord King humbly and as if with rising tears entreated each and every one of the citizens cordially in heart and voice to forgive him his anger and every sort of rancor and malevolence towards them. As he publicly confessed, he had often, and his officials more often, done them all kinds of injury by injuriously confiscating, occupying, or retaining their property, and by frequently violating their privileges. For this he asked them to be pleased to pardon him. The citizens, realizing that anything else would be inappropriate, agreed to everything the Lord King demanded. But absolutely nothing that had been taken away was restored to them," unquote. So it appears that finally, because it appealed to the barons and also it looked like the monks of Westminster Abbey had joined in, this whole matter about the abbot taxing London was finally dropped. But remember, there are two other factors driving politics always at this time. One, his need for cash. But then there was also the passions being inflamed by the ongoing crusade. Not only had a sizable contingent of English crusaders left to join it already, led by the king's uncle, the veteran crusader William Salisbury, but a much larger delegation was ready to go and join them. And by 1250, the issue of supporting the crusade actually brought London into it. On the 27th of April, quote, "The most important amongst the English crusaders gathered at Bermondsey in London to discuss arrangements for their expedition, for they declared they would not put it off on the king's account. Indeed, they judged it shameful to put off the salvation of their souls or defer their service for the heavenly king to that of any earthly king. So they fixed the date," unquote. There we are. Here we are in Bermondsey, south of the River Thames, next to Southwark, and a whole bunch of crusaders agreed they would leave to join the Seventh Crusade on the 24th of June. Quote, "The number of knights with their followers assembled was reckoned at 500. Their attendants and the people attached to them formed a countless multitude. For everyone in the Kingdom of England and many from the Kingdom of France who had got ready before the Lord King of England took the cross were waiting for so famous an expedition. But the Lord King, busily prying, had found out about these proceedings and by means of gifts of money and promises of more, quickly obtained letters from the Roman Curia on authority of which he could suspend their expedition until he, as the principal leader, could set out overseas in force and in his own person. In this way he would travel more appropriately and in greater safety," unquote. So basically the king used his wealth and influence to get a letter saying the 500 crusaders couldn't join the crusade until he was ready, and then he stalled. And this delay actually had a significant positive side effect. The crusaders were no doubt chafing at the bit, but they actually avoided the debacle that was the Seventh Crusade because of this. But again, the previous story is illustrative of the many vicissitudes in the English body politic caused by this king, who is clearly very, very bent. Henry's need for revenues had distorted the entire domestic polity. It was said that he, quote, "ordered the expense of his court and the customary pleasures of hospitality to be cut back, even so as to incur the reproach of inexcusable avarice. He also ordered the usual gifts in alms and the number of candles in the church to be reduced. However, it was praiseworthy that he carefully freed himself from debts from which he was bound to many merchants," unquote. So, actually, he finally seems to show some prudence when it came to his spending. And of course, there were other ways for the king to raise money. A few years earlier, the French king had raised the funds for his crusade by unleashing a series of measures upon France's Jewish community. Fortunes had been extracted during a wave of anti-Semitic pogroms right across the nation. Several Jews had fled the country, some had come to England. But Henry III saw an opportunity to raise cash. Quote, "In these same days the Lord King became dry with the thirst of avarice, so that, laying aside all mercy, he ordered so much money to be extorted from the Jews that they appeared to be altogether and irredeemably impoverished, for he demanded whatever they had in their chests," unquote. The king got others involved in this anti-Semitic move, and actually allowed London to assess and tax its Jewish residents like the other citizens of the city, whereas before they'd treated them as subjects who answered only to the king, offering this as a bone to London. And, quote, "At the same time, the Lord King sent justices of the Jews throughout the whole of England to investigate all their money, both in debts and in possessions, and with them a certain most wicked and merciless Jew to accuse all the others corruptly and in violation of the truth. He reproached without fail Christians who were grieving over and bewailing the sufferings of the Jews, and called the royal bailiffs lukewarm and effeminate. Gnashing his teeth in fury, each one of the Jews, he claimed with a great oath that they could give the king more than doable what they had given, although he was lying through his teeth," unquote. It is noticeable there, not so much the nature of the pogrom against the Jewish community in England and in London, but it's that little quote that there were clearly some who were grieving and bewailing the sufferings of their Jewish neighbours, and some royal bailiffs were lukewarm towards enforcing this. I think that's significant. It offers one ray of redemption to the anti-Semitic feeling that infected the people of this land at the time. As the city settled into the mayoralty of John Norman, it does seem to have calmed down its rows with the king. His focus on not allowing the Crusaders leave, coupled with him using the Crusades as an excuse to bleed the Jewish community dry of cash and the ending of rows over raising cash for Westminster Abbey, does seem to have calmed things down. Maybe relations could start again. However, then came another argument, and it came in the form of another political player, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Boniface of Savoy is one hell of a character as Archbishops of Canterbury's go, and he was a big deal, not just because of his post. One of his sisters was the Queen of France, the other of his sisters was the Queen of England, and a third sister was married to the King's brother Richard. Although it must be said, Matthew Paris summed him up best when it was noted that Boniface was, quote, noted more for his birth than his brains, unquote. By all accounts, he was an overbearing, imperious, and arrogant Frenchman who expected to be treated regally and would occasionally step on people's toes. And in 1250, boy, did he step on a lot of toes. The Archbishop went on a tour around the south of England, visiting different abbeys, monasteries, and churches. And when he showed up, he basically demanded money, taxing said churches in the name of the papacy, or at least claiming to. Now, regular listeners to the Story of London may have worked out by now that there is nothing that can so rile up a bunch of meek churchmen as stepping on their traditional rites, and for many places the clerics were fairly furious at the Archbishop for doing this. How furious? Well, supposedly the complaints about the Archbishop from the priests and monks in England were pretty brutal. Quote, "It is our own fault that we suffer this, because we have sinned against his predecessor, the blessed Edmund, whom we thought was austere and strict. We are putting up with what we truly deserve, having chosen a foreigner, illiterate, unknown and inexperienced, more suited to and experienced in warlike than spiritual affairs. What predecessors he had, martyrs, genuine teachers, holy confessors of God. Alas, why did we obey the earthly king in this outrageous election rather than the heavenly," unquote. Wow, tell us how you feel, Father. And then, with this atmosphere going on, Boniface came to London. Yeah, light blue touch paper and stand back. Archbishop Boniface, quote, "came to London to visit the bishop and the chapter and the monks of that city. He established his household without permission from anyone, neither the owner nor the custodian, in a splendid house belonging to the Bishop of Chichester, which is not far from the lay brothers' houses, not staying in his own house in Lambeth. He got his marshals to obtain his provisions violently and fraudulently, with threats and shouts from the King's Market, to the harm of the tradesmen there. He invited few or no guests to his table," unquote. Oh, this does not bode well. And then on the next day, quote, "going to the chapter of St. Paul's in London, he came to that church in great pomp in order to visit the canons. They were unwilling to admit him, resisting spiritedly, and firmly appealed to the Supreme Pontiff. When the Archbishop heard this, extremely annoyed and threatened, he precipitately and in the spate of anger and fury excommunicated the Dean," unquote. So, Dean Henry of Cornhill, the Dean of St. Paul's, was technically excommunicated, because we get the impression here that the clergy of St. Paul's and the Archbishop's men engaged in some kind of physical struggle, literally, physically preventing the Archbishop from entering St. Paul's. And then it gets worse. Quote, "on the following day, still swollen and inflamed with yesterday's anger, and according to the testimony of people who saw, wearing a coat of mail under his vestments, he came to the Priory of St. Bartholomew to visit the canons there," unquote. Apparently wearing armour now, which tells us more about the kind of struggle that had happened at St. Paul's the day before, the Archbishop was coming to Smithfield and the church of St. Bartholomew the Great. And I can't even describe it better than the report written down by Matthew Paris. Quote, As he arrived and entered the church, because the prior was away at the time, the sub-prior came out to meet him, accompanied by the convent in procession, with solemnity and reverence, both in the lighting of numerous candles and in the ringing of bells. They were in costly choir capes, the most precious of which was worn by the senior one of them at the time, namely the aforesaid sub-prior. The archbishop did not care much for the honour thus done him. He said that he'd come there to visit the canons. Now, all the canons were in the centre of the church, that is, the choir, and the archbishop himself and the greater part of his retinue pressed together in a disorderly manner. One of the canons replied to him on behalf of all, saying that they had an experienced and diligent bishop whose task was to visit them when was necessary. Nor would they, or ought to they, be visited by anyone else, lest he should be seen to be held in contempt. On hearing this, the archbishop, flying into a more furious rage than he ought or was proper, rushed at the sub-prior, forgetting his station and the holiness of his predecessors, and imperiously struck that holy man, a priest and a monk, with a fist as he stood in the middle of the church, truculently repeating blows, now on the aged breast, now on the venerable face, now on his grey-haired head, and yelling, "This is how English traitors should be dealt with!" And raving horribly with unrepeatable oaths, he vehemently demanded that his sword be brought to him. And this tumult increased, and the canons tried to rescue their sub-prior from the hands of so violent an aggressor. The archbishop tore off the precious cape that the sub-prior was wearing and broke away the clasp, which is commonly called a morse, and it was decorated with gold and silver and gems, and it was smashed and lost underfoot in the crowd, unquote. Like, wow. That escalated quickly. And it gets worse. Quote, "Nor was the archiepiscopal fury averted even now, for like a madman, pushing and forcing back that holy man with a violent onslaught, he so crushed the senile body against a pier which divided two other stalls and which was made for a podium, that he shattered the bones to the marrow and caused internal injuries. When others saw the archbishop's lack of restraint, they managed to rescue the half-dead man from the jaws of death after pushing the aggressor back. When he was thrown back and his vestments fell aside, his coat of mail was plainly visible to many, who were horrified to see the archbishop in armour. And because of this, not a few maintained that he'd come there not on a visitation or to correct errors, but rather to provoke a fight. Meanwhile, his officials, who were impetuous provincials like himself, truculently assaulted the remaining canons, who were unprepared, unarmed and unwarlike. And together with the archbishop himself, following his command and example, they ill-treated very many of them by hitting, wounding, throwing to the ground and trampling. And as a result of this, the canons came with feet disfigured by blood and bruises, badly hurt, unshaven and wounded, to the bishop of the city, and tearfully lodged a serious complaint about this detestable affair, to which the bishop replied, "The Lord King's at Westminster? Go and describe this to him, so that the least he may be disturbed by such a violent and manifest breaking of his peace in his principal city." Unquote. Yeah, the Archbishop of Canterbury, he just kind of, he had a bad day. Yeah, I think it's fair to say. He's just kicked off, just beat the crap out of the canons of St. Bart's. As you do. So, what happened? Well, quote, "So four of these canons, the rest being unable because of the pain of their wounds, went to Westminster in order to gain access to the king, in view of a crowd of very sympathetic people who detested such a preposterous deed. They showed everyone the marks of the blows, namely their bruises, swellings, and torn clothes. The fifth, namely the aforesaid sub-prior, was in no way strong enough to go to court, either on horseback or on foot, but was carried groaning to the infirmary, where he was put to bed. He passed the rest of his days in a state of weakness. But the king, though they waited a long time at the door of his chamber, would neither see nor consider the complaints of the aforesaid canons. So they returned in great confusion to their polluted church, which the said archbishop had profaned with the blood of priests and monks, unquote. It is worth saying here and now, reminding you that St. Bart's wasn't just a church. Well, it was no longer the miracle factory it had been, as we described back in chapter 60 of the story of London. It was still a beloved place of worship. In many ways, the people's spiritual home within the city, as opposed to the formal Grand Cathedral of St. Paul's. And the citizens of London took the two assaults upon the two principal churches of the city by the Archbishop of Canterbury very badly. Quote, "Meanwhile, the entire city was convulsed with excitement, and the citizens proposed to ring the communal bell as if rebellion had broken out, and to cut the said archbishop in pieces, whatever the consequences. As he hurried to his house at Lambeth, insults and reproaches resounding, and crowds of people rushed about searching for him, shouted, 'Where is that ruffian, that impious and blood-stained aggressor, not a gainer of souls, but an extorter of money, who was promoted neither by God nor legitimate free election, but was intruded illicitly by the king, illiterate and married as he was, and whose foul infamy has now polluted the whole city,'" unquote. Yeah, I'm not too sure if a baying mob would be that eloquent in their insults, but you get the impression of what was going on. I like the idea that Paris describes that the citizens thought about ringing the bell as if rebellion had broken out. You may remember in the previous chapter when I described the rebellion against the Empress Matilda, it was the sounds of bells that had brought London's mob out. They were clearly wanting to kill the Archbishop of Canterbury here, however which way they were articulating it. But, Matthew Paris goes on to say, quote, "Soon after, having travelled secretly along the Thames, he made a serious complaint about this to the king, justifying himself as a defendant and vigorously accusing the other party. Then he complained even more energetically to the queen." The king, who was in great fear of rebellion, had it proclaimed in the city by public crier that no one was to interfere in this dispute on pain of life and limb, unquote. Well, it's fair to say relations with the king were now back under strain. Yet the physical threat of the city's residents getting involved was curtailed, at least now in principle. However, the city's clerical authorities in London united as one. Because not only was St. Paul's and St. Bartholomew's involved in this, it became clear that the monks of the third of London's three big churches, Holy Trinity Priory over in Aldgate, had become involved and had also joined the other two in condemning the Archbishop of Canterbury. Archbishop Boniface, however, was not backing down and, quote, "encouraged by the king's favour, solemnly renewed in the chapel of Lambeth the sentence he had pronounced against the canons of St. Paul's, including also the Bishop of London in it, together with the aforesaid canons as a supporter. The canons, having suffered harm and injury on all sides, tearfully entrusted their cause to St. Bartholomew, whom they served perpetually day and night, praying, since man either would or could not, that God, the Lord of vengeance, would deny to punish such great offences." Unquote. So yeah, the archbishop started a fight, caused all this, and was excommunicating the bishops, the canons, the little people of London, and above all, the poor monks of St. Bartholomew's. Although it should be noticed that this matter actually ended a few days later. Quote, "The archbishop, still fuming with anger, proceeded the next day to the manor of his called Harrow, about 7 miles distant from the monastery of St. Albans, in order to make a visitation there. And at that place he renewed the aforesaid sentence," unquote. Harrow had, of course, been the place the previous Archbishop of Canterbury, Anselm, the patron saint of Carons, had fallen out with the then Bishop of London. But it was here that it appears that someone finally got through to Boniface. Some high-ranking, not London-based cleric had pointed out that this was not a good look for him. As the record says, quote, "But when he was told by his friends and clerics, discreet and learned men, about the noble privileges conceded to that church by the apostolic see, he dissembled and refrained, and having returned, got ready to cross overseas," unquote. Yeah, yeah, people pointed out, you can't do that. You've messed up. By church standards, you've messed out. And to save face, well, Archbishop Boniface left England after this disastrous tour of churches in 1250 and didn't return for 2 years. Meanwhile, quote, the Dean of St. Paul's in London, a good man, aged and of great experience, Master Robert Barton, and Master William of Lichfield, discreet and learned men, canons of the same church, with the proctors of their bishop and of the aforesaid canons, also went to papal curia to lodge a complaint about this with the Supreme Pontiff, having been insufficiently instructed to prove their point and strengthened by the testimony of many people, unquote. So yeah, this was a mess, but it was eventually solved, and maybe next time the Archbishop could, you know, not attack people. And then, like a thunderbolt, everything changed. News arrived from the Holy Land. The great and mighty crusade of King Louis IX had failed. At a single battle, the king and most of his army had been defeated, and those not killed had been captured. The shockwaves from this moment echoed around Europe, causing vast confusion and dismay. How was this possible? I could spend hours talking about how this impacted upon the French and the papacy and more, but suffice to say that those crusaders who'd remained in England suddenly realised that they'd been spared a terrible fate. Now, the story of what happened to Louis IX in the Holy Land became this epic tale where he was able to ransom himself and remained in the Kingdom of Jerusalem, basically holding it together for a few years and having wild times with Mongols and assassins, yes, the actual original assassins, the militant Ismaili Muslims, and much more. And the legacy of this will pay out in the history of the city in time. But for now, I'm going to close the year 1250 and start a new decade, and as I hope I've illustrated, London and the kings were at odds almost constantly. Be it with him directly, the king chafing under the confines of the spirit of the Magna Carta, or with the powers around him, like his uncle the Archbishop, or his ally the Abbot of Westminster, or even with loyal, supposedly city citizens like the former mayor and sheriff Nicholas Batt, or the disgraced alderman Fitzmary. The divisions and issues Henry III was causing in London was provoking its residents. We had just seen it claimed that the citizens of London were willing to kill the Archbishop of Canterbury for what he'd done up in Smithfield. Relations with the Archbishops of Canterbury had not been this bad since the arrest and execution of William Fitzosbert back in chapter 79. London was clearly moving towards its boiling point. And while all of this was going on, down in the English King's Lands of Gascony, the king's brother-in-law, the charismatic Simon de Montfort, was defending his territories and coming across as competent, able, bold, and decisive. The Earl of Leicester was the kind of leader anyone would be happy to support and get behind. Welcome to the 1250s, a decade where London and Simon de Montfort were going to join forces, and all hell was about to break loose. We'll leave it there. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you could follow quite a few quotes in that one. I'll be back again next week for another episode of The Story of London. See you then. Bye.